Woohoo!
Welcome to the Somewhere Called Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
It's Tuesday.
Tuesday!
Freaking Tuesday. We got sunshine streaming in. It's
yeah.
Fantastic. It's countering the fact right now that we are currently recording on decaf coffee. What is happening?
We have both gone off coffee. So what's happening here for the listeners? Why would we do such a terrible thing, such a travesty to our senses of being?
Travesty is the exact word I was going to use. It's like I had this beautiful Scrabble word and you played it first. It is a travesty. I went off coffee for my heart.
Yes.
And I think it's actually helping. I don't know. I'm also on a lot of medications. So I think it's probably the medications and not the coffee.
Granted, if your ticker is malfunctioning a bit, you shouldn't just throw like nitrous in there or whatever. You should probably let it just chill.
Very true. We also brew sludge as coffee. So anytime anyone comes over and drinks our coffee, they kind of break out into these like unintentional dance sessions.
Yeah.
And have to like walk around the house furiously because they have so much energy.
They break out in unintentional dance sessions and hives, actually. Yeah. My thing is like, if some is good, more is better. Give me that sludge and I will be able to run. That is why I podcast. It's purely for the sludge.
Very few people go to Starbucks and are like, this is weak sauce. That's how I feel. That's how I feel about our coffee. But we are currently on decaf and I don't know, it's feeling, okay, to me, it's feeling
yeah.
good. You decided to join in the fun and I was like, why would you do this? Are you a normal human? So you decided to like join me and
yeah.
in solidarity and jump on the no coffee train.
Well, my thing is like, if you're on that level, I want to meet you there, right? No matter what it is. Like, I don't need to be taking your heart medication perhaps, but like, I feel like it's kind of unfair if I'm here just jacked up to the roof all the time. And, you know, you're living a much more mellow existence. You're on that Matthew McConaughey energy where it's just like, all right, all right, all right. And I need to be there with you.
I'm just applying the ultra shuffle to
yeah.
life. I mean, right now I'm doing work and I'm just kind of steadily plodding along. But there's not a lot of energy in that plod.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice in some ways. Like, I don't know. I feel like it's this very peaceful zen sort of situation where I'm always perhaps 5 minutes away from a nap. But it's at the same point in time too, I kind of miss those frenzied work sessions
yeah.
where I'm like, I will send this.
I miss the extreme anxiety I felt all the time. For me, it's mostly to be there with you. Also, it's because my dad, he ended up having some heart issues and he needed to go off all caffeine. So I'm like, okay, well, maybe there's some genetic influence there that I should pay attention to. And then also my Whoop has been telling me that I haven't gotten 100% sleep. So their recommended sleep ever, to the point that the Whoop has just given up. It's just like, you know what, David, we've lost all hope. You're never going to get to 100. And then meanwhile, I've gone off coffee since Saturday and I've hit 100 every day. What's going on?
We've been sleeping like 11 hours. It's
yeah.
wild. What is going on? It's bonkers. I don't know. I kind of like it though.
Yeah.
I feel like you actually got me introduced to coffee. So I didn't drink coffee until my junior year of college. I don't know how that happened or why that happened.
It's so wild because you were so busy all the time back then. How did you get by? Did you not consider coffee or did you not want it? Did you not like the taste? What was going on?
I think I was just powered by anxiety. I was
okay.
good. I got it. I
yeah.
was like cruising through and was totally fine. And then the first night that I stayed over at your place,
yeah.
you made me a cup of coffee that morning. And I think it was kind of your way of like hooking me into the relationship because
yeah.
you're like, here's your little cup. I'm like, Joe, you're going to stick around, aren't you? And I had it. And after I had the coffee for the first time, I was like, I must go for a run.
Yeah.
What is going on? And then I drank coffee every single day after. So you got me turned on to coffee and now we're going off together.
I really did train you much like a dog in the sense that our first date was ice cream. So you associated me with ice cream. And then after you stayed the night for the first time, I gave you coffee with a fuck ton of creamer. So I found the key to your heart and it's through sugar and a lot of caffeine. It's through jacking you up so high that like I could be, you know, a 78-year-old with like shaggy hair and really smell terrible. And you'd be like, you are sexy as hell right now. We need to bang at this moment.
If you gave Buddy the Elf this cup of coffee that you made for me that first morning, Buddy
yeah.
the Elf would have been like, too sweet.
Too sweet.
I mean, you put creamer in there, you put chocolate, you put sugar, you put protein powder in there. I really didn't feel like I was drinking coffee. I felt like I was drinking some sort of like, I don't know, something straight from the sugar department. And it was delicious. And then gradually over time, I started
yeah.
like reducing the sugar load in it and
yeah.
became hooked.
You'd become like almost black coffee by the time you had to go off. But now we're doing decaf, so we're not doing nothing. And we're not saying everyone else drink coffee.
Actually, there's a lot of health benefits
yeah.
to drinking coffee. I mean, I know Inside Tracker, which is a company that does a lot of blood work, looking at blood biomarkers. They often recommend that people drink coffee, which I agree with. Coffee is great for health. But it's been kind of nice. I feel like we're just on these like chill, very chill wavelengths.
Yeah.
I think if major like leaders in the world are thinking about starting war, maybe we should have them go off decaf coffee or go on decaf coffee and see, and reevaluate their choices. They would be like, well, we could stage a war or we could take a nap. Yeah. And I think we're going to take a nap because that's the overall energy I'm feeling right now.
That's all we need to do. Putin needs to be on that decaf. Actually, I was thinking that yesterday. Everything was taking so much energy. So I think yesterday was my low point. I'm feeling pretty good right now. Maybe it's just the podcast and I'll crash after because I have really solid energy. But I was like, man, how did people like build buildings and stuff? Because like right now,
That's complex. I'm I've been on this for a little, I've been on decaf a little bit longer than you have. And the other week I was like, how do people say sentences? Like not even buildings. I'm talking very basic building blocks of the world.
Or like even have sex. It's just like, we could have sex or we could nap for like the seventh hour. What do you want to do?
Let's just lay here and hold hands and otter. That sounds very sexy when you're on decaf coffee.
But yeah, actually it reminds me of a book Megan made for me within a few months of when we started dating, which she called The Red Book. It's a play on The Blue Book, which is the law school citation device. So this is now almost like 12 years old, 11 years old. And in that book, there was, it chronicles all of our initial flirting before we even met on back and forth on Facebook Messenger. It is cringe as fuck. Would you agree?
It is cringe as fuck. There are some moments in there that I'm like, why did we say that to each other? Yeah, yeah. Why was I attracted to this man? And why were you attracted to me? This is weird. But I mean, I think, but that being said, there's a lot of like authentic weirdness and good vibes and some really funny jokes in there mixed with some stuff that I was like, I don't think it would get us canceled, but I'm like, why did we say that?
It would get us canceled for sure. And in fact, I think everyone has that in their messages. I wanted to read something from it, which is to confirm your lack of coffee at the time. And you said, and this is one of our first messages, as a fairly competitive person, I couldn't resist commenting that I could probably outdo your sleep threshold at the time being. Given 43 seconds, I could sleep absolutely anywhere. Fortunately, stoplights in North Carolina are mostly operated on sensors and rarely surpass 41 seconds. So my sleeping skills, while cutting it close, are still within safety regulations.
Safety first. Safety first.
So now we've like jumped on the sleep bandwagon all over again. So our nap times have gone up, our sex times have gone down, and it is looking very decaf in the Roach household.
But that being said, I mean, that might not be good for health. Like sex is outstanding.
Oh, no. I'm hoping that we adapt at
we
some
adapt
point.
Over time. Yes.
Because right now, just pure nap city all the time. So, you know, hopefully we're bringing a little bit of energy today. I'm starting to feel really good. And I have an extra benefit. And if you've listened to the podcast, you are going to laugh at this confluence of events that we're about to talk about. And this all centers around the amazing, swagtastic, self-assured company, Athletic Greens.
So 2 weeks ago, you might recall us naturally talking about Athletic Greens. Yeah. We found them. So we recently traveled to my mom's house in Philadelphia and she had them in her refrigerator and you were intrigued.
So I'm intrigued because, okay, your mom, she just turned 60 and she's the best athlete I've ever seen. She's so, like, she is the definition of health. And by that, I don't mean like I haven't seen her blood numbers or anything. I more mean that you see her and you're like, I need to be what she's on because she is she like exudes this delightfulness and energy and radiance. And I was talking to her about it and she's like, oh yeah, I just take this one thing, Athletic Greens. And of course I'm like, okay, get that in my belly, especially because I looked at the container and it was certified safe for sport. And then I looked at the ingredients and I'm like, oh, there's good research on all of that stuff, but I haven't been able to go on it because I want to be on safer sport stuff. So I started taking it and I felt damn good right away. Speaking of what we just talked about with sex, it also seemed to feel good in that area. It helped, as we said, it helped my potency. So I was like, okay, this is really cool. And we bought some to have at home when we came back. And I've been taking it ever since and really, really liked it. And we talked about that. But in the context of talking about it, I also said, I think my exact quote was that it tasted like blended lawn clippings. I'm not sure exactly.
And something along the lines too of it tasted like shit, in which I countered, I debated with you. And I was like, actually, I mean, I personally think it tastes delicious. Yeah. I like the taste of exotic things. I think I have exotic taste buds. I wouldn't even call this exotic. I think it's delicious. Like when I drink Athletic Greens, there's something about it that maybe it's the overall feelings of like potency where I drink it and I want to say huzzah. So that was what I took away from this experience. Well, very different experiences.
Yeah. So a number of people messaged after that and they said, You might want to like blend it or whatever. And then in that process, I learned that I wasn't just not blending it. I wasn't really stirring it.
So, not even, I mean, you put zero effort into stirring it. You were basically drinking clumps of long clippings. Yeah. Like you weren't even drinking blended long clippings.
Yeah. So it was texturally not exactly the most satisfying experience I've ever had in my whole life. But I kept doing it because it felt great. And my HRV on Whoop was going sky high. And it stayed high. And I don't know what exactly it is about it, but I'm almost positive it's athletic greens at this point, because then we did interventions with some of our athletes, including some of the pro athletes that have chronically low HRV, so people that have been reporting this, and they saw benefit too. So this is really cool. What's going on here? The big thing I think is that it kind of acts like a multivitamin. It's meant as an all-in-one replacement, but on top of that, it has all of these herbal ingredients, some of which are really backed by research, but you know, are a little scary to take, also expensive as hell if you're taking them alone. So, you know, I really liked it. And then sure enough, after the podcast episode, we got a message from Athletic Greens after we said they tasted like blending long clippings. And I was really scared.
Not even, I mean, this wasn't even like, I don't know, hours after the podcast episode. It was like 30 minutes after we released the podcast. So someone at Athletic Greens is listening to, they're like one of our first listeners of the podcast in terms of it comes out, they listen right away. And I was like, they want to sponsor us after that conversation? That seems shocking to me, but they did.
I like it. It's the ultimate swag, right? They're like, we don't give a fuck. You're taking it, right?
And they're like, we trust our product. It's going to make you feel great. Yeah. So no matter what you feel about its taste, it's going to work.
I mean, I think that's a really cool thing is that like, they didn't care. And they even actually, as you're hearing this, we don't have things we have to say about them. They're like, hey, we trust you as long as you're being honest about your enjoyment.
We'll see how long that lasts. That might last a week or two.
This might be a one episode thing. I mean, and that gets back to why we do this in general. Like, we're like, actually, I think this can help people. I think it can replace a lot of multivitamins. Basically, it's a multivitamin, but without iron and vitamin D. And then as you're going to see, if you use the code we're going to give you, you can get a vitamin D dropper and then take an iron pill if you need it. So it's an all-in-one. I take it in the morning. Don't have to think about anything else the rest of the day. Plus, it has lots of cool things that are backed by research. Examples that I mentioned before is they have ashwagandha, specifically the KSM-66 formulation, which I've wanted to take because it's backed by research. It lowers cortisol and improves testosterone. This might be the potency secret here. But I haven't taken it very often because it's scary to take something that isn't certified safe for sport like this is.
They also have CoQ10 in it, which is fantastic for heart function and focus. Rhodiola, which is an adaptogen. We talked on the podcast when we shared Athletic Greens first about slippery elm bark because we were like, it has slippery elm bark. How cool is that? I've never heard of it before.
I guess I did shit on them for that too.
Yes. Well, we actually had a podcast listener reach out who's an expert in slippery elm bark. And they're like, slippery elm bark is the jam, guys.
Yeah.
And so I learned it's a form of mucilage. What a fun word.
I like
that.
That's
a noun. So mucilage is a thick, gooey substance from plants. Doesn't that sound appetizing? But it's a really good, so slippery elm bark is a really good natural digestive aid. It like soothes the intestinal lining. So there's all kinds of goodness in here.
I'm a little skeptical of that until I see some control studies like I've seen for ashwagandha. But a thick, gooey substance from plants, it reminds me a little bit of ovulation tracking.
Does it? It really does. It's tracking your mucilage.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You got to track your mucilage. It's the only way to know when you're fertile.
It's very important.
That's something that if you haven't gotten to that point of your life, you're going to learn a little bit about mucus soon. The other thing I learned is, like I said, it has basically everything you need. One thing it doesn't have is iron, because a lot of people don't need iron, might overdose. If I put in a little bit of Vega protein powder, which tastes great, then I can put in chocolate Chex, which has 70% daily iron. And I am stocked up on everything I need just from this one thing. So
you're adding Athletic Greens to your protein cereal.
I am. And it has changed my life. It tastes delicious.
It's funny because we are like reversing roles here. Yeah. You were skeptical about the taste. And now I'm skeptical about that, but you love it.
Well, you know how I am with coffee. I just put it all in there. The more sugar, the better. And that's kind of where I'm at right now. Though that being said too, this is also not an actual endorsement, but check out Chocolate Chex while you're at it too. That cereal has 70% of your daily iron. So I just do like a few servings a day and don't need an iron supplement.
It might be more addictive than coffee.
That's true.
It's so good. We had one point in our relationship where I was like, David, you cannot keep buying Chocolate Chex because I eat it at rapid quantities. And you just kept buying it. And I have to kind of put it in this like drawer of the cabinet and kind of forget that it's there.
Don't even get me started on peanut butter Chex. So that stuff is, I don't know. I think that should be banned like on like federal code, like federal law, because there's no way to stop.
Wait, do you like peanut butter or chocolate better?
Oh, I like peanut butter better, but I just can't. I mean, that's one of those things where I will eat the entire box at every time, which is fine in moderation, but not so fine when like, I go to Inside Tracker and my glucose is too high. So that all brings us to, like, we actually love this product. And you can go to athleticgreens.com/swap, S-W-A-P, athleticgreens.com/swap. Basically, this is a wholehearted recommendation. I'm not sure if we're going to be sponsored by this company for long. Like, it doesn't, it's not about that. This is about something we think can actually help you. Also, kind of a funny story about saying something tastes bad and then having them say, hey, reach out and do this.
And if you go there, so they give you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D with your purchase. Yes. And it's a vitamin D dropper, which is a great way to tailor the amount of vitamin D that you need. And then 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. And they've got all kinds of cool swag there. They even give you like a little shaker bottle that I'm like, this shaker bottle is, there's something about it that's like aesthetically very pleasing to me, which is something I would never say. I am not a like a shaker bottle expert, but yeah. I love this one.
It does have like a lot of a tech industry vibe going where you open the box and it's like, ah.
You're like, where's my iPhone in here?
Yeah, exactly. So we really like this. It's obviously a little bit expensive, but that's because it's supported. It's taking away, you know, all of the need for all of these supplements. Like my expenditure on this stuff is going to go way down. And I've noticed a really massive difference with how I feel in performance. So athleticgreens.com/swap, S-W-A-P. I recommend subscribing. You save a lot of money. You get all this stuff. And, you know, you also support the podcast you're listening to right now. So yeah, we're going to have a lot more funny stories over time on that subject.
And you get to, you can drink something in the morning and pound it and say, huzzah, because that's the energy I feel when I have it.
And it can replace coffee. You're like, how do these people have energy when they're not drinking coffee?
Why are they still talking on 1.5 speed naturally? And it's because of Athletic Greens.
The answer is lawn clippings directly into my veins. This might not last till next week. Zooming back to the weekend, we have a bigger discussion here that we want to have on some DNFs, do not finishes, which are pretty topical for running. I also think they're topical for life. So we're going to start.
Is it do not finishes or did not finishes?
I don't do tenses, Megan. Verb noun agreement is not my shit. Back off. But yes, yeah, so whatever the correct answer is, DNFs. So I had an experience this weekend where I was like, okay, last second, I want to hop in this race that was down in Salida, which is a 3-hour drive from where we are here in Boulder.
And for context, you were being kind of like the all-star husband in this situation, uh-huh, because you were afraid to leave me overnight as I'm dealing with this heart stuff, which was very kind and a little bit too kind. I was like, David, I'm fine. Or we could find a babysitter. Like, yeah, surely someone in Swap would come over and sleep in our house so that you feel like, I don't know, that you feel just understood that I'll be fine overnight. And I can't travel to altitude. So you decided that you were going to drive. You're going to wake up at 3:30 in the morning, drive 3 hours to Salida to race a marathon race, and then drive all the way back home. And I was like, David, I don't know, something doesn't add up about this. That seems like a lot of stress surrounding racing.
So that's not a big deal. I mean, I used to do stuff like that all the time. It's more that as I was driving over these mountain passes, the snow got higher and higher and higher. And I sent you a picture.
You kept sending me pictures of all the snow. And I was like, dude, turn around.
Yeah.
Come back home.
You did say that. So the race started and it actually wasn't snowy. It was great. There was some packed snow, but that's it. And we hit the high point at mile 15. I felt really good. It was a good situation. And usually when I hit the high point in a race, we always look at profiles before the race. And it's like, wherever the high point is, it's free. The rest of the way is free. Like, you can just, I've never lost a race when I'm leading at a high point or whatever.
I was gonna say, if I could bet on racers and you were in anywhere actually from like first to fifth place at the high point, I would bet, I mean, your downhill abilities are so strong that I would pick you to win every time.
Well, so I don't know about that, but perhaps compared to uphills, I do like the help of gravity. Gravity is my friend, and I'm very close with it. And sometimes we get a little bit intimate. And that's what I was planning. I was planning on turning around, getting intimate with gravity, and then celebrating and driving home and, you know, getting to hang out with you. But that is not what happened, because as I crested the hill, I started running through snow, which shouldn't be that big of a deal, but it was like 6 inches of, like, you know, sometimes post-holy snow, not too bad. And so I fell once, that was fine. I fell the second time and twisted my ankle. And this ankle twist wasn't something that should have been a race ender necessarily. I've had a lot of races where I twist my ankle.
I was gonna say, I think at this point your ankles too are just scar tissue. When you say that you sprained your ankle or rolled your ankle, you're just ripping up old scar tissue. Like, everything in there is gone.
Yeah. So it was bad, but it wasn't so bad. But then what happened is that compounded with the snow, where it just took out any desire I had to suffer through that ankle and through the snow to the finish. So I ended up doing the walk of pride, I guess, or walk of shame, back to the
start finish. How far did you have to walk back to the start finish?
It wasn't too bad. I mean, I got to mile 22 in the race. I was still...
Oh, so you basically covered a marathon. I imagine if you get to mile 22 of a race and you have to walk back to the start
finish. And I was still in second when I decided to stop. But I was just like, I couldn't do it anymore. My brain had switched off. And this is contrasted with like other experiences. I want to make clear that this is not because of my ankle, though that contributed. In 2014 at the 10K national championships, I had a similar fall ankle turn at mile 2 of a 10K. And I didn't think too much of it during the race, but then stopped and couldn't even get to the car without crutches. My guess is that was...
Well, you won the race. You finished. You won the race.
But the point being, like, if I was equally motivated, I would have been fine.
Yeah.
But I wasn't and didn't really want to finish. And I knew like that. I knew going in that that's not what I wanted. I wasn't just out there to suffer. And, you know, so I DNF'd. I did a walk back through the field. Got to cheer on a lot of people, which is pretty cool. So you're probably if you're listening and you got to see me cheer, hopefully I was kind out there as I, you know, gimped my way down the mountain.
Well, I think I'm thinking of two things. So one, you were incredibly, we talked about this in the last podcast, so fit heading into that race. Like, and I think the interesting thing about trail running, and this is the beautiful thing that makes trail running, is the idea that we are not just testing fitness out there. Like if we were testing fitness, we would all be running on a track.
Yeah.
And we're testing so many different things. And I think your specific running form just doesn't mesh very well in snow. You put out a lot of power with each stride and also have pretty high kickback too. And so I think it makes you not a fantastic snow runner, but the situations in which you have to run in 6 inches of snow are so limited. Well, like, you almost never do that.
And I would probably never put myself in that situation. Like even in winter, I don't run through snow. And it was kind of like, it was an important lesson to not idealize running and racing. Right. And I think I really did before that race. And I did, I mean, for the whole first half, I was living my best life. I out there, I saw one of my athletes who was just doing her training run. I stopped and gave her a hug. It was Lindsay Herman, actually, as we're going to talk about her a little bit later. And, you know, I was just so joyous. And it was almost like the idealization of it ran up against the reality of it, mm-hmm. which is I didn't want to be in that environment. And I don't mind technical terrain usually.
I mean, you're a great technical.
And I think this might run into like, you know, wanting to be home and all that other stuff. But I think it points out more generally that DNFs are nothing to be ashamed of. Like I was talking to an athlete on the phone yesterday and she asked me, so was that your first DNF ever? And I was like, oh my God, that is not my first DNF ever. I have DNF'd so many times over history, often right in proximity to the best performances of my entire life.
In fact, in 2014, I think you had three, 2014, I think was one of your best years of racing. You were on a
role. I won.
You got sub ultra trainer of the year.
Yeah.
And I think you DNF'd three times that year, which is, and also at like shorter races too. Yeah. So not necessarily races that are, you know, like over the 50 mile distance or anything like that. And I think it just goes to show, like, if you are racing and putting yourself out there enough, like this stuff happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you're being smart. Sometimes there's like so many different reasons that go into a DNF. But I think though, you kind of like brushed over this. I imagine that walk back where you're freezing cold, where, you know, you're DNFing a race, where you're coming back into half marathon finishers has to be really tough. Like every time I've DNFed before, it feels like a major, major, major life issue in that moment. Like it comes with crying, it comes with frustration, it comes with questioning why I'm doing the sport. Did you have any of that on Saturday? Like what was the drive home like? What was the walk back to the start finish like?
I did regret actually a little bit putting myself in the situation that I didn't want to be in. But then I always zoom back and I'm like, okay, when we tell people like on this podcast or in coaching or even talking to each other to take risks, to shoot your shot, essentially the implied narrative of that is don't be afraid of DNFs or don't be afraid of failures because it's going to happen constantly. It's the only reason that any of this happens. So I could have stayed at home at 4 a.m. and not driven down there and none of this would happen. Or I could have gone down there and learned some shit that we're talking about on the podcast now and that I've learned over time. Like, you know, I say this to athletes all the time. Like, I don't necessarily think race wins or peak achievements teach you anything, right? It just confirms everything you're doing, which isn't necessarily productive. I think everything that is really great in life usually comes from a really like kind of low negative point. So fortunately, my lows aren't that low anymore. I understand I've DNF'd a million times. I hope I DNF a million more. In fact, my biggest concern is I didn't have any negative experiences in my race calendar all last year. That's not good. That's a bad thing. It's a sign that I'm not putting myself out there and I'm not being courageous. It's a sign I'm being a little bit of a coward when it comes to racing.
Well, it's an amazing way of putting it about thinking about courageousness in the context of that. I think for me, it gets down to, we've talked on this podcast a lot about Pete Holmes.
Yeah.
And he has this expression that sometimes things in life just aren't for you.
Yeah.
And that's like an amazing way to frame things when it's a struggle or you just feel like something doesn't align with you. But I feel like this race in many ways just wasn't for you.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've struggled at races and it feels like it's this broader trajectory of where my running career is going. But in reality, maybe it was the terrain or the elevation or something about that specific short race that wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And it just happens.
Like, yeah, you've DNF'd too.
We both DNF'd at the same race, the Moab Trail Marathon. It's running on Slick Rock. I have such a hard time navigating Slick Rock. So the way that they mark courses on Slick Rocks is often with paint. And I find myself off course so many times because for whatever reason with my running form, I struggle to follow the paint.
Yeah.
And we both DNF'd at two totally different points in the Moab Trail Marathon and found each other wandering near the start finish way before the race was supposed to end. And we were like, oh,
yeah,
you DNF'd too.
That's a compatibility test. What Hinge should actually look like. It's like, hey, are you both going to eat shit at the Moab Trail Marathon? Is that not for you? Actually might be connected. Like Slick Rock and snow both do not seem to suit me very well. But to zoom this out more, you know, I think that there's this caustic, terrible phrase, death before DNF, that you often hear thrown about in athletic communities. And it is like, fuck that. That is not the way to view life. That all of these things that we might frame as DNFs, and this is Zoe Rome's amazing podcast, DNF, gets into this in a lot more detail. What we might frame as DNF is actually the ultimate chance to learn. So like what I often tell the athletes is the point of racing and any time you take a risk is curiosity. You go in it with this curious mindset and you try to learn some things, good and bad. And DNFs are the ultimate chance to do that. So, you know, even though this, I wouldn't necessarily have wished that experience on myself this weekend. I wish I would have won. I wish it would have gone great. It didn't. And now I'm left with a fuck ton of growth. And it's like, well, thank you. Thank you to this experience because, you know, I owe past ones like this for everything, like not just in athletic, not just in running, but in football before it, in law, and basically everything I've ever done has been fueled by DNFs.
I totally agree about that. And I also appreciate you bringing up the concept of death before DNF.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about, I wonder how many people that say that and like truly hold to that phrase have had near death experiences or major medical, like major medical experiences in their lives. Because I think once you experience one of those two, you recognize too, you're like, it's not that important. I promise. Like as I'm going through this heart stuff, you know, I haven't run in 4 months. And I think I imagine going forward, I will handle DNFs much differently because it's like, all I want to do is just cover ground on the trails and be healthy and be running. And I'm just curious about like, the statistics of like health issues in that population. I think once you go through some of these big struggles, it changes how you think about DNFs or it changes how you think even about like racing trajectories.
Yeah. Well, it's also, what are you fucking afraid of? Right.
Yeah,
like what are
exactly,
you, what are you hiding from in saying death before DNF? And it's like, no, actually it's not. They're totally different things. DNF is a part of life. It's a beautiful part of life. It is often a bloom that looks like, you know, a cold winter.
It's Super Bloom by Mr. Wives.
Yeah. Super. It's such a super bloom. And so the story specifically about my life, is when I was playing football in college. So I went to college to play football. Talked about that a little before. I never really talked about the mechanics of quitting. So I went there and I went to college and like, I thought that this was my entire life. This is the whole reason I went to the college I went to and was like, oh my God, this is so not for me. Much in the same way of hitting snow. I was like, no. And
at what point did you, was that day one or did it take a couple of weeks to realize that?
Day one, I was able to convince myself, much like the first few steps on snow, this will be fine. Like I'm good. This is good. And then I started falling a little bit. And so by like week four, I was like, I hate my life right now. Like I hate it. I was dreading waking up in the morning.
And what was it about? Was it, you know, getting hit in football? Was it the structure? Was it the team environment? Was it the culture?
It was realizing that this life I had chosen was a totally different like color than the one I wanted. Like by color, I mean like vibe, aura, everything about it, everything that went into the way you ate, the way you treated your body, the way you treated others, the way the social dynamics worked. It felt like I was playing a character and I could only do that for a short period of time. But in college, in high school, that you could just confine that to windows around games. And in college, I had to be so on my game all the time that it became me. And I didn't like who I was becoming. And, you know, getting my ass kicked didn't help.
I'm sure getting tackled real hard every day doesn't help. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, things were going pretty well when I had walked into the coach and was like, I can't do this anymore. And, you know, that was that. And the weird part is even now knowing that all of the amazing things that led to like that, my entire life was formed by that decision. And I'm so fucking proud of that decision. I regretted it for all 4 years of college.
I was going to ask, what was it like the next morning when you woke up? Like, did you feel a sense of loss or did you feel a sense of excitement or purpose?
I think I remember crying happy tears. while being on the crosswalk above 116th in Amsterdam in New York. And I think that was while it was raining, knowing that I was in like loneliness was what was waiting for me. But also knowing that I was being true to myself, like it was so, it was such a burden on me at the time that lifting that burden, even as I knew it was going to be a shit stew, felt, you know, really good. It felt cathartic. It felt like being true to myself. So before we talk about your DNS, I want to take a step back for the listener right now and talk about your bra change that just happened. You are now in a black bra and you were in a yellow bra. Look what happened?
You are paying attention to detail, man. Look at this. I'm impressed.
I pay attention to boobs all the time.
You very rarely pay attention to detail around the house. Like you could tell me the colors of my bras right now, but you can't tell me how you organize cereal in the pantry. It's very interesting.
You just, as long as it's in proximity to a nipple, I will remember. That's what we should have done in law school. It's just like nipples next to the most important concepts. It's like if nipples were next to, I don't know, consideration in contracts law, I would have definitely crushed that class.
Well, I'll just have to put like little, like, you know how they have the head cutouts? I'll just have to put boob cutouts in our pantry. That way you can actually remember to put back cereal when you're done.
That's such a good
thing. It's the greatest invention of all time. So yeah, we actually, the way that we record podcasts is on Anchor, we do 30 minute recordings. And so we take a break at 30 minutes. And my other bra got very sweaty.
Oh.
And it was uncomfortable. So I had to change. There is nothing worse in life than like a wet, sweaty bra that's sitting on your chest. Every time I do a run, I get so cold after and I'm like, I have to take this off. So I'm always changing in the parking lot, trying to like do various contortions to get this bra off and not flash the entire parking lot. But that's what I did. And it's so nice to have some dry bra nature going on right now.
You just feel free in your chest, like your whole sternum area just feels
wonderful. I just feel dry and wonderful. Yes.
You know how happy it makes me to make you dry. Oh, that was terrible.
That was gross.
No, should we edit that?
No.
No, we're just sticking with it. Okay, more importantly, let's talk about your DNF. So we just talked about mine. I mean, that's just a little bit. Obviously, I'm a running coach now when I was a lawyer. So that was a DNF too. We talked about that a little bit more before. But like, I'm fascinated by your trajectory because like, I mean, do you want to start with field hockey? Because I think that's a really interesting one where, you know, I got to see when I went back to the East Coast, like the extent of your field hockey achievements. Like you weren't just a good field hockey player. You were on track to be a national team player, you know? And I mean, you invested your entire life in that. And I mean, you stopped playing field hockey in your early 20s.
Well, I actually stopped. I really did invest a lot in field hockey. Yeah. And then somewhere around sophomore year of college, I kind of put I just opened my eyes and was like, where am I going with this? What is going on? I really wanted to be pre-med.
Yeah.
And so I just started having different focuses in my life, started loving like outdoors and running and finding all these different things. But my field hockey suffered as a result. Like I, you know, spent the summers not playing field hockey, which is a big deal. Like most of the players who I was competing with would spend all summer playing.
Yeah.
And I was doing, I mean, I was taking courses, I was doing other things. I studied abroad and I was just kind of broadening my horizons. And I think I looked back on that for a long time with regret. Like it was the same regret of like feeling like a DNF from a race.
Uh-huh.
And now though, I mean, I have the perspective 11, 12 years later to think about that. And I'm like, I am so grateful for that.
Do you ever have any regrets about it though?
I do and I don't. I mean, I think I definitely didn't satisfy who I could have been as a field hockey player. But I think if I had satisfied that, I wouldn't have gone to med school. I wouldn't be studying science. I wouldn't, maybe I would be in like trail running, but not to the extent that I've been.
Yeah.
And those are such important parts of my life that I look back and I'm actually really, really grateful for it. But we had the experience of going to Philadelphia and seeing my coach and he was expressing regret. And it was it was kind of funny being in that position where I was reassuring him. I was like, no, this is actually great.
Yeah.
Like I'm studying science. I'm, you know, doing a PhD. I'm loving this. I'm trail running. There's like so much richness to my life right now. And a lot of that is because I diversified away from field hockey early. And I was almost convincing him of that. Yeah. And it was just an interesting reflection on how far I've come on just accepting that and understanding that that was part of my path, even though it came with a lot of like frustration and challenge and regret early on.
And identity reformulation, which is interesting.
Exactly.
But what strikes me most about that, about the coach, is the narratives that other people form and trying to conform to those narratives and how much that can influence a life, right? Like I think when a lot of people DNF, their first thought is like in a running race, let's say, is how are other people going to think about this?
100% Or like, what? How am I going to write this on Instagram?
Yeah,
what's that caption?
Or on Strava. I mean, when I DNF'd, I very specifically did not include any excuses in my Strava file.
Which actually I was like, dude, you should, everyone was like, what's wrong with you? I was like, you should just tell them you rocked your ankle in snow.
But no, I mean, my point is it's not, I don't ever want that to be a thought that I have when I'm living my life.
So you don't want to, you don't want to be out there indulging that.
Yeah. And how is someone else going to consider this thing that is a internal journey, right? It's like, yeah, you need to know. Yeah. Like friends that reach out, I'll tell them, you know, but other than that, like, why would I be, if I did that, if I wrote something like, if I sent a picture of my ankle, it would be like almost trying to make sure to validate my own existence and tell people that, you know,
I don't know. I agree to some extent. Like, I think you don't need to indulge these thoughts while you're out there. Like, I think there's very much sometimes when people have 8 million excuses after a race, it's highly annoying, or, you know, there's like different connotations there. But I think also that's part of the story. And just as if you had a good day and you would tell the full story, I think it's okay to share the full story of the DNF. Like, that's not making excuses. That's not, like, you're not the type of person that makes excuses. And I think you just need to have confidence in that and be like, yeah, sprained my ankle, is a bad day.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you have to be like, it was a bad day, I won't tell you anything about it, because those are excuses.
It's not withholding. It's just saying that, like, I don't need to narrativize things for social media necessarily in a way that also devalues the DNF.
But I guess I think if you share that story in other contexts, you should also share that story when times are tough too.
Oh, because it's, I get it. But my thing is,
that's not making excuses.
I don't want people seeing it to be like, oh, well, he has a reason for that. So mine that doesn't have as good of a reason.
Yeah, but they might come up with their own reasons themselves. They're like, is he dying? Does he, you know what I mean? And so I think
I think the role of a leader in this community is sometimes modeling that failure is just failure, not failure with an asterisk.
Yeah, but failure happens because of number of circumstances. And it's okay to share those circumstances.
That's what the podcast is for, right? Yeah. I don't think Strava is for that.
That's actually a good point, is we're talking. We just provided and shared the whole story. And sometimes you don't have to do that in specific meetings. So
that's my thing is, like, a one or two sentence throwaway with a picture of my ankle would make people think, oh, he DNF'd because of that ankle. There's like a reason. But actually, I did not DNF because of that ankle. And that's what I want to be really clear about. I DNF'd because I did not want to be out there, which is a purely internal decision. I could have finished for sure.
True.
And I want to make sure that other people that are listening to this that have ever DNF'd anything understand that you are loved and you are enough. And you don't need to have a reason for that DNF aside from it not being for you.
I totally agree with that. And I really respect how you've approached this and shared that. But I would say, though, that, like, if there are things that, like, if shit happens to you, it's okay to share that shit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's fine too. Sure, and those aren't making excuses.
Oh, I totally agree on sharing the shit. I just think, like, you don't need to always have, I don't know.
You don't need to always have a reason.
Or you don't need to fit into someone else's outside narrative. I mean, I think we all think of that all the time. And getting back to, you know, the story that you're talking about with field hockey, the narrative from the outside, or perhaps even more interesting, your story in med school, where, you know, you're at Stanford, you're on this track to accomplish all of these things as a doctor. And everyone at family reunions is talking about the doctor. Everyone on social media is like, Megan the doctor. And you decide, you know what? I'm not going to be a practicing doctor, which throws the narrative for a freaking flip. So you couldn't have been considering the narrative, because the narrative wants you to go down one path, right? And what gave you the courage to do that?
It's a good question. And it almost didn't feel like a DNF in the moment. It almost felt like you were in a race and you're out there and you're like, this race is way too long. Like, you're starting a 100-mile race and you're like, you get to mile 20 and you're like, why the heck am I doing this? And so it's almost like I decided to do the 50K instead of the 100-mile, but I decided at mile 20.
Yeah.
And so in some sense, it's this accomplishment of, like, feeling like you graduated med school, like, you know, things are looking good, but you also didn't do the full 100-mile race. And there's some, like, regret and longing and questioning, especially as you see, like, right now I'm starting to see a lot of my classmates in med school and in college go on to become attendings. And it's like, you know, having that perspective of finishing the 50K and seeing the 100-mile finishers come through and being like, well, what did they learn on their journey? Yeah. Are they satisfied? Are they happy? Like, was that fun? And I think there's just a lot of interesting questions that go along with that.
Do you have any regrets from that decision anymore?
I don't really. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't love working at my computer all day.
Yeah.
And that's largely the role of a researcher with a lot of meetings. And I really truly miss patient interaction. Like, there's something magical and special about talking to patients about, like, tough medical decisions or just being there for them when times are tough. And I think you learn a ton about, like, human interaction in just, like, the ways of life and values of life. And I miss that in the research world. But I felt like if I was going down that residency path, there was like, so I was closing the door on so much love. Yeah. Like I love running so much. I love like our time outside. I love our time adventuring together. I love the relationships I have. And I felt like I couldn't do all of that. And so in many ways it was like DNFing with a lot of love in my heart. Yeah. And that made it easier, or, you know, running that 50K race with a lot of love in my heart. And I still look at that and I'm grateful for it.
Well, maybe that's such a beautiful reflection, DNFing with love in your heart, right? Yeah. Because I think whenever any of us DNF, like there's a temptation to default to shame or questioning or worrying about some narrative. And if you can try to come back to love and the loving response, but mostly to just to yourself, the better. And, you know, that's like what you helped me with a lot of after all my DNFs. And basically everything that we've ever done is tied to a DNF. And that's pretty damn cool. And I think it also applies to just about everything in life, like absolutely everything. So, you know, there's a bunch of different stories that we've written down here, but I just wanted to share a couple that, like, if you're out there and you're worried that, you know, you've taken one of these DNFs or you're thinking about it, time to do it. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about shooting your shot. It's not like nailing the shot. It's like failing and then seeing what happens next. Like that's where the magic happens.
And I think you don't have to have an understanding of where that DNF is going.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I think a lot of times when we reflect on DNFs, they seem very neat because we have the added mm-hmm. advantage of time. We're like, oh, well, that DNF allowed this and this and this. But oftentimes when you're in that moment, you can't see the future projected ahead. It's just this big wad of uncertainty. And you're like, well, I guess I'm going to dive into that and figure out where it's going. And it's only in retrospect that you're like, that DNF was pivotal. And I think that's where the courage comes in,
yeah.
is recognizing like, hey, I'm going to dive into the uncertainty.
The big wad of uncertainty.
Doesn't that sound, it sounds like this like mushy piece of gum that you're like, yeah.
I think it sounds like a cosmic principle. Like outside of the black hole, just beyond the event horizon is the big wad of uncertainty. one quick, very quick story I'll just tell is I saw this amazing story about Max Crosby, who's a defensive end for the Oakland Raiders in the NFL. He had tried to go sober many times before and had tons of setbacks. But then 2 years ago, he made the decision. Here's a quote from him. "I knew I couldn't just drink like everyone else. I got ahead of it. My first year of sobriety was the hardest. And that was last year. I had a lot of ups and downs. Mentally, it was really tough for me. But going in now, I'm almost a year and a half sober and life is great. I'm really enjoying every single day. I'm enjoying the work." So, you know, he had lots of ups and downs and DNFs on that journey. And then the other day, on the 2 year anniversary of his sobriety journey, he signed a 4 year, $98 million contract. And it was the ultimate moment of like, oh, fuck yeah. This was the big wad of uncertainty wrapping up in kind of a neat little bow.
And a moment of irony. And I imagine all the different feelings. He said, "The odds of that happening are so low, but it's also ironic. I know in the last 2 years how much work I put in, how much sacrifice, so much growth in everything I've been doing and seeing it paying off. Obviously, this is just the beginning of where I want to be, but this is an incredible gesture by the team, and I'm just fired up to get back in the playoffs and continuing chasing a ring." And I don't know, I love this example because I think sobriety often requires these like periods of rebounding from DNFs that feel like this moment that you can never rebound from. Like I imagine the walk back, like the proverbial walk back to the finish line from a sobriety DNF has to be one of the hardest things in life. Yet we've seen people like rebound from that time and time again.
Yeah. You've coached people, right? That have gone through this.
Major issues with sobriety or addiction and have, you know, been committed to that journey even through the DNFs in a way that I think is very similar to ultra running and running.
Yeah. And not just running, but like literally everything. I mean, so, you know, obviously running DNFs are incredibly tied to eventual success. Like there's no value in finishing unless it's something that you need for some reason in your running. But then also relationship DNFs. If you're in a shitty relationship that doesn't lift you up, you don't need to be in that relationship.
No matter how long you've been in that relationship even if you're at mile 80 of 100, like you don't need to be in that relationship.
I mean, you know, if you're married and whatever, and if you have kids, you can like make sure you're always doing the things to try, right?
Yeah.
Similar to the race. Like I didn't DNF as soon as things got hard. You work through it. But also at a certain point, it's not for you, and that's okay. Work DNFs we've talked about. And the place I want to end this is on self-care DNFs. This is specifically thinking about like people that have struggled with things like eating disorders or disordered eating. And so many great stories here, but much like the addiction discussion, basically every triumphant journey we've ever seen shared on Instagram or whatever, like behind the scenes, it involves good days and bad days. And highs and DNFs that like, if we're written about in the moment would be too traumatic and too raw and too real for people to identify with. It would be, you know, just like an open wound put on online. And those DNFs always lead to this amazing place, but only if the person gives themselves the love to fail. It's not death before DNF. It's like life all the time. Just life happening is, you know, those DNFs happening, and we have to be okay with that.
And I think from what I've seen from athletes that I've coached with eating disorders, it's also to just understanding and accepting, very similar to running, that like recovery is not linear at all. Neither is running trajectories, and just having to be okay with those peaks and valleys and understanding that that's not the final destination and that like you can keep working. And it's not also like a reflection of self to struggle with this. It's just part of the challenge. It's part of the unique nature of it. And can I read this quote? So Lindsay Herman is an athlete on SWAP, and she has been very open about struggling with an eating disorder and recovering and just working to get the help she needs. And she's been, I think her writing on Instagram is powerful and captivating. And she wrote this caption the other day, and we both were like, we need to read this on the podcast. It's so beautiful and so well done.
Yeah. So she was at the race actually, just doing her long run. And I got to see her in person for the very first time after all these years. And I just gave her the biggest hug, and I almost cried on the course because I'm like, oh my God, you're the most inspirational person ever. And she's not the most inspirational person ever because she had a problem. She conquered the problem. She wins the race. It's because it's a messy stew that she's, you know, navigated. So she wrote this post on Christmas, I believe, this year. And so do you want to read it?
Sure. She wrote, 2 years ago on Christmas morning, I ran 8 miles on these trails with my dad, honestly, barely keeping up with him because I was in a constant state of exhaustion. 2 years ago, the only thing I can remember about those 8 miles was that the eating disorder monster that controlled me was sighing a sense of relief that the smallest size running tights they make were barely staying up over my hips. Of course, the monster wasn't satisfied, but at least it was comforted in that moment. That's all I remember from the entire day. I do not remember Christmas 2 years ago. That's all my starving brain could focus on. This morning, I ran a workout on these trails and I felt strong. This morning, I soaked up the gorgeous New Mexico views. This morning, I took selfies with my dad and stepmom at the trailhead. I remember my run this morning. Recovery still feels like a mountainous struggle most days, but I am strong. I am learning that when the eating disorder monster makes demands, I hold the power to tell it to fuck off because I am no longer its slave. Today, I am strong. Today, I'm chasing my wildest dreams. Today, I feel like a strong athlete, a loving friend, a present human. Whatever you're struggling with, keep fighting. We've got this. Merry freaking Christmas. Tears of joy today.
That is so beautiful. And I mean, the big conclusion there is that it is a fight, right? Like the ups and downs of life, whether that's striving in a race and not having it meet your expectations at the very low end of the things that matter spectrum, or eating disorder, or a relationship, or divorce, or an addiction, any of that, like the low points, those DNFs that happen along the way are not like stop. They're not a verdict on what you're doing being wrong. They're just a verdict on you living your life fully and putting yourself out there and shooting your shot. So let's celebrate DNFs as much as we possibly can, right? As much as we would celebrate any win, because I think that's where the magic of life and growth actually happen.
I also really appreciate the way Lindsay highlighted the present moment and feeling like she was able to be so just captured in that present moment and appreciating the little things. And I think that when you go through DNFs, like whatever that might be in life, I think it truly does make you appreciate like the magic and the mundane in that present moment, because you're like, I'm just so grateful to be here. Like I've been through the shit, and now that it's like not as much the shit, I'm really grateful for it. And I think that appreciation is also something that comes from it, no matter what happens or no matter what trajectory that you're on.
Cheers to the shit. We're going to move on to a few movies. We got a lot of people saying that they liked our movie discussion. So
they sent us recs too. I was like, thanks guys. This is great.
So yeah, these are a couple of the recs, but mainly we're just kind of throwing a few out there. First was Dune. If you haven't seen Dune because you're skeptical of that sort of movie, it was shockingly good. I loved Dune. Dune was great.
I don't know why you were shocked. They compared it to Lord of the Rings. So yeah. I was like, I'm sold. And once they compared it to Lord of the Rings, you became skeptical. So I think that describes kind of our relationship with like fantasy and movies. But you actually liked it. I liked it too.
I love sci-fi. It's just sometimes when it's like, there's like swords and they're saying like the house of whatever. I'm like, really guys, what is this all about? We live in the modern era. We don't need this shit. But Dune was amazing. It was so beautifully shot. I didn't realize at the time, but it was by director Denis Villeneuve, who has also made a lot of the other movies we're going to talk about today. It was great. Really recommend it if you've been skeptical like I was of jumping into that deep end. The next one from the same filmmaker is called Arrival. You might've seen this from 2016. It's essentially an alien movie about linguistic science. So language science. Very cool.
It was so good. It was interesting though. So the way it was shot, it was very dark, like the entire time. And not I mean like dark as in mysterious, like the color of the film was actually dark.
Yeah.
So like I felt like they needed to like turn up the brightness on the movie a little bit. But that actually paralleled like the overall trajectory of the story too. I feel like when they shot this, no one in that movie and no one directing that movie had any coffee because they were on the same like peacefulness wavelengths that we were on. And I was digging it. Like at times, maybe it felt a little slow, but I felt like the narrative was so strong and I was just aligning with their lack of coffee that it was great.
I love, all of his movies kind of just wash over you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a shot that could be 5 seconds.
They make you think.
Yeah. Oh, no, they all make you think. They're great.
Yes.
But a shot that could be 5 seconds is always 10 or 15 seconds. But it's beautiful and it's good for presence. It's good for a coffee-free lifestyle. So really recommend Arrival. And the next, another movie he made was called Blade Runner 2049.
It 2450, was, right?
2049. 2450. No, you skipped ahead a lot. Probably be a very different world. But it was very, it was 2 hours, 43 minutes. Also very good. But I feel like he got a little bit up his own ass by the end of that movie because like every shot took forever. But it was amazing. We loved it. I would just say I caution with that one.
We actually didn't finish it.
So yes.
The last 30 minutes, we can't attest for the last 30 minutes of the movie. So we had 2 nights to watch it and we couldn't even finish it in 2 nights, partially because of our coffee situation, partially because it was kind of dragging on a little bit. I felt like it could have ended at 2 hours and 15 minutes and we'd have been content.
Yeah.
We did Wikipedia it though to know that you last night you were telling me what happened based on Wikipedia and that was helpful. It had a good ending.
Yeah, we cried to the Wikipedia ending, the 3-sentence plot summary. But no, it's a great movie, just a little bit more hesitance. And then we watched Mad Max Fury Road, one of the best reviewed action movies of all time. Everyone loves it. It's clearly a work of artistic brilliance. It was not for us.
Interesting. Definitely not for us. I don't know. So I'm not a huge fan. Like I like action, but I kind of like action when there's like right alongside narrative. And this opened, there was about 25 minutes of them driving across the desert for like 25 minutes straight. And granted, okay, the costumes, there's actually a really cool YouTube on this. So the stunts are incredible in this movie. And you can actually go to YouTube and Google a behind the scenes montage and see how they did these stunts. And you can do that instead of watching the entire movie because I think that encapsulates like the whole sense of the movie from what we got. But I just felt like someone just really wanted to drive across the desert for 20 minutes and light things on fire. The overall sense I got from the movie.
It was extremely cool. I would say it was bitching. That would be sometimes with action in movies, I'm like, okay, get to the point. I'd much rather whenever anyone says they don't like exposition in movies, I'm like, exposition is what it's about. Tell me a story. Don't show me it's like, you know, they say show, don't tell. I'm like, tell, don't show me that action scene right now. I was getting a little bit like, oh, is that guy with the big hook for an arm going to hook that other person? And why are their nipples like that? There's a lot going on. It was very BDSM style.
I was going to say, it was very BDSM. And I learned, I don't think I had any BDSM tendencies after watching that movie. Like I was not into the overall portrayal of that. Whereas last week we talked about Ex Machina and the robots. And I was much more aroused by robots than I was by any of this BDSM stuff. So that, I don't think that just like fits in our overall trajectory of life.
So Mad Max has a lot of people like hooked up to chains and things are going on that look painful. And
And even the way that like the characters interact, I think it's very like BDSM like too.
Yeah. Well, at least there feels, I mean, not
at least in the first 45 minutes of the movie, that's all we can attest to.
Not knowing much about that world, I was like, it just kind of like grosses me out. But Ex Machina, on the other hand, was like very clean robots that really wanted to bang.
And that was the vibe I was feeling.
Maybe that's our sexual vibe. Those
robots were clearly drinking Athletic Greens.
Yeah. Oh my God, they were so potent.
They totally had slippery elm bark in their systems.
So much. Yeah, that should be the next question on Hinge is Mad Max Fury Road versus Ex Machina. But a brilliant movie that also would be interesting. But while watching that movie, had an interesting reflection, which is Tom Hardy, who was one of the stars, an amazing actor. When he was filming Batman and he was going to be the character Bane, he was asked about performance enhancing drugs by Men's Journal. And his response was to look at the camera and very deadpan said, "No, I took Smarties," that sweet little candy, as opposed to performance enhancing drugs. I don't know if that's exactly an admission. It might just be being annoyed with the questioner, but it does bring up a lot of interesting points about how we conceive of what is normal in society and what is not. So these men that get super bulked up, there's an amazing article in 2021 in Vox that essentially indicated that they're all taking almost all the steroids under the sun. And that's Interesting. I mean, not enough people talk about that, I think.
They had a quote from a top trainer who trains a lot of these Hollywood professionals. And he said, actors are trying to get on camera and blow everyone away. Everyone's just maxed out, doing everything possible to look superhuman. And I think that's so true. Like, I don't think we probably even fully understand the extent they're going to look superhuman. There's probably like genetics, like all kinds of like weird things they're doing to their body to look the way that they're doing. But I think it's when you see it on screen, it's such this element of effortless perfection that I think I get frustrated that like there's not more of these open conversations surrounding what it takes to look like that. Because like, you know, we're showing these to young kids, we're showing these to, you know, just vulnerable. We all have vulnerable minds. And it just, that seems like a frustrating element.
Well, it's interesting in the context of athletics too, because comparing to superhumans is what athletics is as well, often. And so maybe some of the people with genetics, much like athletics, also maybe some of the people are doped on that Lance Armstrong horse shit rather than, you know, like just athletic greens or whatever. You know, maybe it's like really bad stuff. And so another thing from the article, if movies, television shows, Instagram posts, magazine covers, and everything in between keep telling us these bodies are sexy without saying they're unrealistic, it can do a number on, in this instance, men's brains. For some, this is confounding, leaving them stuck and unhappy with their results. Others who are savvy enough to know that gaining 25 pounds of muscle isn't really realistic may seek out the drugs to emulate the look. And this actually has connection directly to my football story I was telling. So my senior year of high school, I was a really good player and had all these colleges looking at me. Everything was going great. And I specifically remember playing safety, coming across the middle, a guy caught a pass on a little slant route. And I, as they used to say, jacked him up. And it was one of those hits that still played at the high school for like, you know, as these teams celebrate head injuries.
Which is, it's so weird to me that you were on a football field hitting other people. Like, what I know about you, it makes sense that you had to play a character in order to do that, because it's just like the antithesis of your personality.
Well, what I realized after that is I think it hurt me more than it hurt him. Like, I was initially worried about a little bit of a neck injury. I got up immediately trying to be like, and I was like, and at that moment, I thought on the field, okay, I need to gain weight. I need to get bigger. And I had done it the right way before that. I had gained probably, 5 to 10 pounds of muscle per year. And that was working well for my body. And immediately after that game, I decided, okay, time to put on tons of weight. And I read these things about Hollywood people, about The Rock, like doing all of his chicken and protein and stuff. I probably went on a 250 or 300 gram protein and tons of food. It was so unhealthy.
But
it was
I wonder what that did to like your cholesterol levels. Because I mean, you were saying that you were waking up at like 2 a.m. to drink protein shakes.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's what you read about. I was a kid. I thought that that's what you did because that's what I read these people in Hollywood did, or the NFL players that are the same type of situation. And yeah, I did put on weight. No, it was not healthy for me. Like it might look for them. I think that in some ways set off the trajectory of quitting football in college because I got burned out by the lack of health I was experiencing to just play the game. And so obviously this doesn't just apply to men. This really applies to women as well, both with steroids, like very common in Hollywood and a lot of like, especially I was reading about like human growth hormone for women at this level, but then also for both men and women, plastic surgery.
Plastic surgery is huge. I always assumed that plastic surgery was this big, like predominant thing in the US. I don't know what made my brain think about that, but when we were preparing for this podcast, I was like, I want to do some research and like actually figure out how prevalent like plastic surgery is.
Yeah.
I didn't know this. South Korea actually is considered the plastic surgery capital of the world.
Interesting.
So 1 in 3 women ages 19 to 29 have had some sort of work done in South Korea. And I think they're using the term plastic surgery fairly loosely there. They're defining any like sort of cosmetic based procedure, but that's high when you think about that. And I'm fascinated about like the underlying stimulus that's making these young women want to have plastic surgery to like emulate this look. And it's concerning, but also too in Iran, like rates very, very high there as well. So it's not just the US, it's this global worldwide problem. And I think it's just something that like, I wish we talked about more openly of people just wanting to look a certain way.
And we have no problem with plastic surgery.
If you've
had plastic surgery, fuck yeah, that's awesome. I think the only concern with something like that is that it makes that if other people end up thinking that the norm needs to be something that is superhuman. So plastic surgery, awesome.
Or if that norm comes again with like effortless perfection, it's like, no, well, there was a lot of work that went into to like crafting that look, and that's totally okay. Like
no shame.
Yeah. Whatever floats your boat, it's amazing. But I think it just needs to be talked about more openly, especially for young people.
Yeah. And emulating superhumans, brings people down a lot of negative paths, and it can be so hard, you know, in all of these fields.
And as I was doing research on this too, through the American Society of Plastic Surgery, they actually, so they had something called a mastopexy, which I hadn't heard before, which is a breast lift. And I got really intrigued, but I was like, how, I don't know if I could qualify for one of these. I don't have enough like boobs to lift. Just have to like start like putting ribs and stuff in there.
They can move your nipples to your collarbones, perhaps.
Ooh, that would be interesting.
Yeah, I would pay attention.
But they described why people need mastopexy. And I was like, I got a good chuckle from this. Yeah. So wait for this one. So they said that breast changes and loss of skin elasticity can result from 1, pregnancy, 2, breastfeeding, 3, weight fluctuations, 4, aging, and 5, gravity. So we are all dealing with a force of gravity on our boobs. So that is life. That's the world.
I love that. The force of gravity. I wonder, they should have included all of the other forces. So the strong nuclear force.
Electromagnetism.
And the weak nuclear force. I believe that's all 4. The weak nuclear force as well. All affect our fun parts, perhaps.
Entropy is why we get wrinkles.
Yeah. And I mean, that breast implants actually get back to like a complicated thing of like, again, no shame if you've done this, but I think it's hard when like young women might look at people that have had it and not understand that nature. Right. And it can be really hard. I mean, I can't imagine how hard it is on women, because women, like, I don't know if this is an okay conversation to have. We can edit out if not, but like, women wear this like literally on their sleeves almost, like in a way that men don't. So the amount that men think about their own penises, like, and when they're kids, is so high. And other, like, it's this thing that they're all self-conscious about for the most part. It's never talked about. And their models for what is normal is probably pornography that they see that is also abnormal. Yeah. But at least it's hidden to a certain extent, so that they don't have to feel that shame in an open way. Maybe that would be beneficial in some ways, but maybe that's why they're not getting penile enhancements as much, even though, you know, it might be something that a lot of little kids would want. I don't know.
That's true. Though you can just toss some pads on there. So all these like sports
on your penis?
No. Well, I guess, I mean, you could, but like, I mean, as you're talking about like women wearing it, like, you can wear bras that like, you also don't know, you know what I mean? So there's like all different kinds of things.
But it reminds me of a clip-on penis. Instead of a clip-on tie, just like give yourself 4 more inches.
But I think the other thing too is people get plastic surgery for all different kinds of reasons. Yeah. Like, I actually had plastic surgery on my ear because when I was playing field hockey, the earring ripped out of my ear and left a hole where I couldn't wear earrings again. And I had plastic surgery to sew it back up so I could wear earrings again. And, you know, that's kind of like a procedure that might not be needed, but it was helpful for me, you know, so I don't have to walk around with like a hole in my ear.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's various reasons that people get these procedures. And I think it's like, absolutely, like, no problem. Like, no shame.
Yeah. And it gets back to, you're enough as you are, whether that's with these things or without
with
these things.
With holes in yours or without holes
in yours. Yeah. And it's basically whatever brings you joy. But also to understand the broader context of it, and, you know, give a lot of other people love as they're going through it too. Okay. So the biggest wreck of all, and this is for literally everyone, please listen to this comedy special, Taylor Tomlinson's Look at You on Netflix that just came out last week. It looks a lot at mental health. It is so funny. We laughed constantly.
Yeah, I was so engaged. This was one of those things where if this was a 2-hour and 40-minute special, we would have watched it
straight. Oh my God,
it was so good. Like, we were not going to Wikipedia at the end of this.
I just want to hang out with her all the time.
It was amazing. And she has a unique backstory too. So she grew up religious. She's no longer religious. Her mom unfortunately passed when she was 8. Yeah. And she talks about that very openly in the special and through the lens of comedy, through the lens of other different things. And I was just impressed about how she like highlighted mental health and also like brought mental health into where she is now.
Yeah. So I'm going to read something she first said about medication. And I had friends who scared me too when I tried to get on medication. Quote, I didn't like how I felt on them. I didn't feel like myself. And that was her friends. And she's like, and now that I'm on them, I'm like, yeah, me neither. It's the best. And then she follows up, and I do feel like myself. I just feel like now someone's sitting on me going, shh, we are trying to help you. Go to sleep. Choose a different adventure. And I love that reflection on medication of like, this isn't something to be ashamed of. This is something that helps you actually be more of your true self rather than hiding your true self. And that's kind of what she's bringing out with the comedy.
She did that so well. I remember sitting there watching that and being like, this should be a primer. Like, they should give this at psychiatry offices when they're talking about these issues, because I think she did so in a way that really removed the shame, but also made it like relatable and funny. And I think like people who have mental health struggles probably watch that and are like, yes, like, I feel this. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And I mean, I imagine at least a third of the people listening to this are on mental health medication. And it's like, fuck yeah. So the most important part, I thought, of the entire special is this next part. So long story, she found out that she was bipolar, not from a diagnosis, but from the medication she was put on. It was a fascinating.
I was kind of confused, actually. I was like, I feel like if they put you on medication for something, they should very clearly tell you what it's for. And it sounded like her therapist wanted her to like get on this journey to recognize it herself. Yeah. But if that were me as a patient, I'd be like, yo, no, I would want you to tell me that. Like the moment you think I have, you know, a disorder or like a mental health struggle, I would want you to tell me that.
But maybe it's a lot like the heart stuff that you've been through, where sometimes it's uncertain. And the therapist is putting them on these medications without a diagnosis, hoping it helps. And when it does help, it's like, oh, that is the diagnosis. So you're almost diagnosing by exclusion, perhaps.
Yeah, that is probably how
so, this works. She was diagnosed with she was experiencing bipolar. I'm unsure the exact phrasing you're supposed to use there. So we'll follow up on that. So this is her bit on that. I wasn't sure if I was going to talk about it on stage. And then I needed new material. And I was like, fire sale. Everything goes.
Side note, that's how we feel about our podcast. Yeah. Anything like crappy that happens in your life, you're like, fire sale. Yeah. This is great.
Material.
New material.
No, truthfully, I was surprised that I felt so bad about it because I think I'm pretty open-minded. And I don't think anybody should feel bad if they get diagnosed with a mental illness because it's just information about you that helps you know how to take better care of yourself. Being bipolar, there's nothing wrong with it. Being bipolar is like not knowing how to swim. It might be embarrassing to tell people, and it might make it hard to take you certain places, but they have arm floaties. And if you just take your arm floaties, you can go wherever the hell you want. And I know some of you are like, but Taylor, what if people judge me for taking arm floaties? Well, those people don't care if you live or die. So maybe who cares? Maybe fuck those people overall. And that gets back to the narrative part that we're talking about. I think all of us are a little bit focused on how we're perceived in a narrative sense, like outside of ourselves, rather than just doing what's best for us.
And feeling like we're the only people with arm floaties in the pool, when in reality, you go to the deep end and there's like most of the population has arm floaties and they're just like swimming around being like, don't look at my arm floaties. But everyone's like, don't look at mine either. I have them too.
And instead of that, let's be like, hey, those are some fine ass arm floaties. Let's celebrate whatever those are, whether that's medication or whether that's just like a way of going through and viewing your own life. Like that is great. Whatever makes this experience more enjoyable, more able to choose the right adventure, the better. So we love you all, which brings us to sexy science.
You sexy science time. Let's do it. We've got two sexy sciences that are related. And I think we can do a power 15 minutes on this. I'm feeling it.
Oh, for freaking sure. And also this is this week's Trollrunner magazine article. You can check that out. Actually, this was the article came after this podcast outline. So it shows that the podcast outline sometimes is the driver of the ideas rather than transferring something from one of the articles.
It's fun to see how the sausage is made. Yes. But this article is called Six Sessions of Sprint Interval Training Improves Running Performance in Trained Athletes. And they created an acronym for sprint interval training, which is SIT, which is kind of unfortunate, actually. Like, SIT doesn't really quite like encapsulate the aura that we're going for here. I feel like it needs to be like, I don't know, fast interval training, FIT.
Oh, yeah. That would be so much better.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they were trying to like parallel HIT, which has two eyes. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what they were going for.
I'm not sure. So, I mean, both of these articles essentially look at short-term interventions with speed training and how that affects someone's running economy and fitness and why that might be. So this first study is truly fascinating. It is done in the field rather than in the lab, one of the first studies that ever did that. I think this was early 2018. It had 16 subjects, 12 male and 4 female.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least there's
females. There are some females, yes. Yes.
It's not a full, I mean, it's kind of a sausage fest, but it's not a full sausage fest. Speaking of sausages. And so these were trained trail runners, which is a good thing, that were running at least 50K per week for 3 years. So you wouldn't expect training interventions to result in a huge immediate change. They did some baseline tests. One was a maximum aerobic speed test where they ramped up pace until the athlete couldn't hold it anymore.
That sounds kind of terrible. Yeah. Can you imagine doing, like, I feel like that's one of those tests that's just like designed to be a psychological like fire.
Yeah.
Like as you're like, you're just designed to fail at this test. Yeah. That's how a lot of like tests are done in the lab. But it also reminded me too of a lot of these track athletes when they're trying to go for a world record or a certain time, they're trying to hit paces by lights on the track. And that reminds me a lot of that, of like the psychological nature of trying to hit the lights.
Yeah, that's exactly how they actually did it in this, where they had cones set up. And as soon as they weren't able to hit the cone at a certain time, then they tapped out. It actually makes me a little worried too about some of these studies, because you might just get better at that type of test.
Oh yeah. Like I know for me doing the beep test in college, it's very similar. You have to hit cones at beeps. Like you adapt to that and you figure out how to do that and you figure out pacing for it.
Yeah. So then they had a time to exhaustion test at 90% of that maximum aerobic speed. And finally a 3K time trial. So what the training intervention was just 3 times per week for 2 weeks. They did 4 to 7 by 30-second fast shuttle runs with 4 minutes recovery.
Okay, shuttle runs.
Yeah.
I looked at this and I was like, this is a little confusing. So shuttle runs approximate like what we would do in field hockey or football. So they would have them go to the five-yard goal line, then the 10-yard goal line, then the 15-yard, not goal line, the five. Oh gosh, I've gotten too far away from sports. That is such a shame. They'd have them go to the 5-yard line, then the 10-yard line, then the 15-yard line, and pivot back and forth. But it involves like, that's pretty short, and it also involves pivoting. So I was a little bit confused about how that would impact running economy. Like, yes, they're working on their power, but they're also pivoting, and this is short.
Yeah, and I think they just did it because it made it so that they could have it in a confined space.
That's true.
And encourage them while they were doing it. I don't think it's anything about shuttle runs. In fact,
also shuttle runs are great for competition.
Yeah, that's true. That definitely makes sense. And they said that the results in the study, believe it or not, were less than you see in some other studies. Maybe that's because they're doing shuttle runs rather than on the track.
Like, I think if they transform that to 200 meters, they would see a lot more improvements. Yeah.
But that being said, the improvements were massive. So maximum aerobic speed was 2.8% improvement in just 2 weeks, a 42% time to exhaustion improvement at 90% of that maximum aerobic speed.
What?
That is wild.
That's a lot.
That is so much. So that's more like endurance rather than top speed. And then a 5.7% improvement in the 3K time trial. That is shocking.
That is shocking.
And one other interesting point, actually, is that their interval performance, so how far they got on the intervals, barely changed at all. So it was the fact of doing the intervals rather than improving at the intervals that caused these changes. And not only is that found in this study, there's a 2014 review in Sports Medicine that reviewed 16 studies with 318 participants and found an 8% improvement in aerobic capacity across those participants. So that's VO2 max. What the heck? I don't know why I censored myself there, but what?
Well, I like this. I feel like it confirms a lot of what we think about with training philosophy. So again, we have confirmation bias as we review these articles, because we really like the introduction of speed, but there are a lot of challenges with the study. So I think one key challenge is the idea that there's no control group in the study. Yeah. And so my question actually is it the impact of the speed that we're seeing or the impact of these wild baseline tests that they're doing? And are they actually responding to the speed or the baseline test? And we don't know because there's no control group. And so that's one big challenge. I also think too, ideally you could understand. So we're looking at this from a pure, looking at what is happening with performance, but ideally we could look at what's happening to the body.
Yeah.
And a lot of these newer exercise physiology studies are pairing them with muscle biopsies, which is a little bit more rigorous, but you can actually look at changes in protein levels, changes in gene expression, and that becomes very helpful.
Yeah. And so this study didn't do biopsies. So they're like, we think this is likely due to enzymatic activity, perhaps neuromuscular explanations, the lactate shuttle we talked about, but they were unsure. Which brings up the next study, which is my favorite study of all time. I am not joking around. This 2018 study in physiology reports is my shit. Extremely so.
I'm surprised. How did we get to, we're in the 90s right now in terms of our podcast episodes. Yeah. How do we get this far? We didn't talk about it.
I think we talked about
we've alluded to it.
Yeah.
We've never gone into like the study methodology.
I throw this thing out like I'm throwing out ones at the club. I'm just like, but there was a line from the article that I was pretty proud of. If we were playing FMK, so fuck, marry, kill, I'd F this study, M this study, and K any study that is not this study. I'm also very happy that Schroener lets me use that in an article. So what this ends up doing is looking at the mechanistic explanations for similar results in a much more rigorous way where it's over a longer period of time, so we don't necessarily need the control group in the same way. So again, trained women, 14 men, or trained athletes, 14 men and 6 women.
And it's nice to see these studies done in trained athletes because if you are trying to give exercise interventions for trained athletes, you want the studies to be done in trained athletes. And
so the reason you want these done in trained athletes is otherwise any intervention you do is going to cause improvement and change just because you're training them.
Exactly. Yeah. You could just have them like jog around the block and things would stack up, which is why it's motivating to be a runner because things build so fast.
And that's why Tabata intervals, for example, have shown such like monstrous changes in untrained athletes right away. It's like, oh, well, you can introduce almost any intervention like that and will happen. So these trained athletes were put through a 40-day protocol and involved 10 sessions of speed endurance training. So that's what we're talking about here with the speed. And that was 10 by 30 seconds with 3.5 minutes recovery at near max. And then also there were 10 sessions of aerobic moderate intensity, which is kind of steady running. Their overall running volume decreased by 36% relative to before the intervention.
Which is pretty substantial.
Yeah, yeah. So they decreased their aerobic stimulus while increasing their speed a little bit. Testing was very similar. The first was a time to exhaustion test, much like the one we talked about before. And then the next where they did two 10Ks. One, and both of them had 2 by 6 minutes before at 60% of VO2 max. So,
and when you say 60% of VO2 max, that's basically, I mean, that's to these athletes is jogging. Yeah. I think sometimes that sounds scary, but in reality, that's just jogging.
It's super easy. So they did some easy running followed by 10K time trials. And one of those easy running 10K time trials was done in a glycogen depleted state. So these athletes did 3 hours of exercise the day before to cause them to be glycogen depleted. And that was so that we can, when we're looking under the hood at what's actually happening, we can be like, oh, where are these changes actually occurring? And give us more clues into what the secret here is. And then they did muscle biopsies and blood tests at every stage of the intervention.
So this is pretty rigorous.
It's so rigorous. It kind of sounds painful. It sounds pretty nasty. But very cool for science, because I think that this moves the field forward a lot in understanding why running economy actually changes. And so here it did change a ton. Running economy improved by 1.5 to 2.5%, which is a really big amount in athletes trained this much. 10K performance was 3 to 4% better. And their VO2 max remained the same, but their velocity at VO2 max was higher, which I have here written in all caps. Running economy bitches.
That should have been the summary of the paper.
Yes. That means that your running economy is getting better when your VO2 max doesn't actually change, but your speed at that effort level gets faster, using less energy to go the same pace.
What I thought was interesting was that the blood variables were largely the same, except for the testosterone to cortisol ratio, which oftentimes is used as a metric of overtraining or overreaching. Yeah. And that was actually 31% higher after going through this intervention, which is a good thing. And it's interesting to see how athletes are responding in their blood biomarkers to this focus on speed with reduced volume.
Yeah, and we're not sure exactly why that would be. It could be the reduced volume. It could also just be speed. Like, speed could improve hormone profiles a little bit, kind of like power would. And these very short things might do that. But I thought the most interesting part of all is something I barely understand, which were changes in muscle protein expression and enzymatic activity. So first, on the muscle enzymes, in the aerobic enzymes, all went off the charts high, like 20 to 30% increases in those. But with the muscle protein expression, in the slow twitch muscle fibers, the protein dystrophin increased, and the expression of a protein called UCP3 decreased substantially, both of which are connected to underlying morphological, physiological changes. That's really cool.
That's really cool. Also, UCP3 feels like it belongs in Blade Runner. Like, it belongs in this, like, we're measuring UCP3, guys.
I think more Star Wars, R2-D2, UCP3.
Oh, true.
Definitely a droid in Star Wars. So dystrophin might be connected to the actin-myosin crossbridge, which I don't really understand that, but I think it's related essentially to the stiffness of some of these muscle fibers, which could improve running economy. And then UCP3 is connected to mitochondrial efficiency. But then also in the fast-twitch muscle fibers, the expression of a protein called SERCA1 decreased by 22%, which could have major implications for how energy is consumed during exercise. This all gets back to ATP generation, in that this is essentially a protein that puts a little bit of some pause in that process. Like, it makes it less efficient.
I think that's really interesting when you break down the beauty of being able to do these muscle biopsies is seeing the difference. I mean, a lot of times we've theorized about what's happening in slow twitch muscles versus fast twitch muscles. Yeah. And when you're able to actually pair the intervention with muscle biopsies, you can see that.
Yeah.
And I think it's so cool. And I think we're also just hitting, like, a lot more studies are being done with muscle biopsy. And I think we'll be able to understand this and explain this much better in the future.
One really cool thing about this is the glycogen depleted trials. The reason they did that is because theoretically, that would isolate more for the impact of slow twitch versus fast twitch, because once you're glycogen depleted, your fast twitch muscle fibers do some of the role of the slow twitch fibers. And in the glycogen depleted 6 minute intervals at 60% of VO2 max, they found no change in performance. That was the one place in the study where there was no improvement, which indicates that these changes are not due to fast twitch fibers. They're due to slow twitch fibers, which is so cool, because that means that this speed is not making us less efficient. We don't want those fast twitch muscle fibers. They're actually making our slow twitch fibers be more efficient, more economical. So speed can make you far better at endurance events, not just short sprints and things like that.
If it's controlled. And yes. I imagine the beauty of having this intervention done in person is that they can be there actually dictating and modulating the efforts, which is so important. And I think that's the big part, though, is they're also not like, these aren't like full out 30-second like rep maxes. They're, you know, these athletes are doing it controlled, and that is what really allows like these slow twitch muscle fibers to develop and to have these beneficial changes.
Yes, definitely. So here's a summary from the article that I think is important after we talked about all these proteins. Don't be discouraged. I only kind of know what a few of those words mean. Megan knows I don't. The point is that as researchers introduce short stride-like speed sessions and measure more variables, they often see major changes that may explain the performance differences. So when we use the term running economy, we're actually incorporating dozens of these physiological variables, some of which we can measure and some of which we can't, from the cells to the muscles to the circulatory and cardiovascular systems. Getting faster is a scarily complex algorithm, and that is so freaking exciting. And so, yeah, these proteins, everything we're talking about here, are just one of many, or like some of many of the things that go into improving speed. But in that context, actually doing some faster work clearly helps the body, you know, produce more efficient efforts over time.
And I think this is very cool because I think to me, intuitively, I think about like the neuromuscular and the biomechanical elements of doing speed work. Like that to me intuitively makes sense. And I think as we're doing these studies, the idea that these things are happening like on the protein level to me is like something that's totally novel, but is allowing my brain to grasp the idea too of like slow twitch versus fast twitch muscle fibers and thinking about the long-term scales and the long-term trajectory of developing these, because these studies are done in weeks in athletes. And what happens when you start to stack this? Like what happens to those expression levels when you start to stack this over months and years?
Yeah. And it's tough to know. Maybe the benefits start to reverse even. So it introduces some of the complications, but how does this fit in to everything else? I think looking back on the Norway discussion that we had, where we talked about these big double threshold workouts, it's really relevant that those athletes were doing short hills as well, short, fast hills, often like 20 by 30 seconds, really fast. So they were probably harnessing all of this over long-term cycles. This is common in Canova systems, Lydiard systems, basically every US-based system does strides. So if you're not doing strides, if you're not doing short speed 1 to 3 times per week, do it. For our athletes, it's usually hill strides. But you know, if you feed that in long-term, you can lead to really great results. And so I think the way that the article ends kind of summarizes it, all the complex training theory into like kind of a neat little bundle.
Can I read this? This is great writing.
Go for it.
Mechanical output, neuromuscular biomechanical efficiency, cardiac output, and aerobic development all interact in really complex ways that can be tough to fully predict. What should you do in the face of that complex algorithm governing performance changes over time? I'm not sure there's a universal answer, but I think the studies point to a simple principle that will work for most athletes. Get fast and stay fast. On top of consistent aerobic training and a lot of complex variables fall into the right places.
Yeah, so that's the main way to think about it. It doesn't mean like you're all out sprinting. It can be hill strides. It can be, you know, 30 seconds, much like the study. But if you were able to do that long term, that running economy will then feed back in to everything you're doing, most likely.
It can be recess. It can be time out there, you know, doing light turnover between mailboxes, between trees, there's all different ways to approach this.
Yeah, or as you're DNFing, you can just do a few little runs.
Sprinkle up the walk back to the starting line.
Yeah. And if you take an Athletic Greens at athleticgreens.com/swap, you're just going to be going so fast on these. So do you want to move on to Listener Corner?
Listener Corner. Let's do this. This Listener Corner is touching.
It is
beautiful. Can you read this for us, David?
I will. So this is from S. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Every week for the last 8 months, your podcast has been a shining light, bringing me joy. I listen through to the end, and every time Listener Corner brings a tear to my eye. To hear that others have also found joy in running in life, seemingly alongside me, is empowering and humbling in equal measure. Every week, I think that one day will be the listener that writes in. I will be the listener that writes in and shares a little vulnerable piece of me in solidarity with everyone battling the wonders and troubles of life. Here it is. The last year has had its ups and downs. Sometimes life has been shit. Other times I've been high as a kite on enthusiasm and joy. A year ago, I thought of ending my life every day. I let everything that matters slip away from me, my work, my sport, and my friends. Over the course of a few months, I clawed my way out of this hole using tiny steps dug using a teaspoon into rock, or rock hard earth during therapy. It was slow, but I'm much better now. While dragging myself out of that pit, I found first your book on my bookshelf, Gathering Dust, and then the podcast. Your voices have given me the confidence to be me. You have, largely unbeknownst to you, accompanied me through this journey, and for that I am so grateful. With your company, I have embraced being an athlete, loving running, loving food for the first time in years, finished my academic program, and broken off a relationship that needed to end. Hell yeah, DNF there. This weekend, I completed my first half marathon race. I'm still buzzing over 24 hours later. I'll leave you with a quote that I hope will resonate with you as it does with me, by the children's author Roald Dahl in his autobiography. He's talking about his uncle Oswald. I began to realize how important it was to be an enthusiast in life. He taught me that if you are interested in something, no matter what it is, go at it full speed ahead. Embrace it with both arms. Hug it. Love it. And above all, become passionate about it. Lukewarm is no good. Hot is no good either. White hot and passionate is the only thing to be. Keep being white hot and passionate, even when the going is tough. Swap love. Listener S.
That is so beautiful. White hot and passionate. Holy yes. Cheers to that. But also really, I mean, what that listener wrote is beautiful and vulnerable. And I think these last couple years have been challenging for a lot of people. And yeah. Like, not alone in that. The number of emails that we get about struggles, about people that are just like trying to get by, are numerous. And you're just not alone in this process.
Yeah. And you're so loved. If, you know, intrusive thoughts, like the listener S describes, are super common. We hear about them all the time in coaching. And know that if you're going through that, do not go through it alone. You know, reach out to a mental health professional first, but also us, your friends, your partners. There's hotlines that you need to reach out. Never let yourself experience that and be like, I will get through this solo. That is someplace where, you know, you need a partner right there with you, and you know, we'll help you along that journey, even if we never met you, even though we have no expertise, just as a friend. So yeah, you're fucking loved and fucking awesome just the way you are, no matter what that looks like in the moment. So yeah, rate, review, and subscribe, especially subscribe. Again, if you're at this point in the podcast, subscriptions are the key to our like us being able to continue to do this. And yeah, you're just the best.
Thank you so much. Thank you for getting to this point. You are all awesome. Woohoo!
Woohoo!
Bye.